panic buttons. We've seen them in movies used in bank robberies, but in some big cities, hotels are moving to require their use to protect housekeepers. Hotel workers tell us sexual harassment happens in Waikiki. We don't hear much about it, though. Some hotels have been sued over it. Should panic buttons be part of the business here in the islands? The conversation about that has just begun. Gemma Weinstein was elected as the first woman president of Local 5, the hotel workers union. She worked as a housekeeper for 15 years. She says she was traumatized by a personal experience at the Ala Moana Hotel that happened more than a decade ago. She didn't report the incident and has trouble talking about it even today.
As an immigrant, I'm still, you know, I feel like, you know, when I have to go and talk to my manager, you know, like I said earlier, do they believe on me or not? And but like what happened in Chicago, you know, they did some kind of lobbying about having a panic button, and they did pass that to the legislature and also in Local 28. And in New York, they actually have it in their contract to actually have a panic button, you know, so that they can, you know, prevent the guest or customer or harasser to harass them.
And so explain to our listeners what the panic button is like. You actually hold a device or you have it on your person?
So panic button is actually into, you know, in your, it's on your possession, and if you feel like you're in danger, like if you are being harassed, you can just press that button, and they will, you know, they will know that there is something happening on your floor wherever you are. And I think that's something that we want to have to our workers, and especially in the housekeeping, and also those who work in a restaurant, because it's something that I believe that, you know, everybody need to be respected. In housekeeping, they see, customers see housekeeping is just like, you know, easy to get. And I think that's why most of the time it's happening in housekeeping, because we work there alone with the customer. It's a scary thing.
Right. And so explain to our listeners. So you represent Local 5, and a lot of the members are immigrants?
A lot of members, almost 90% are immigrants, whether they are from Philippines, they're from China, they're from Korea, but it's 90% immigrant housekeeping.
So you think the discussion that we're having about sexual harassment will hopefully put people at ease to be able to step up and speak about their experiences where they maybe they've been reluctant to before?
That's what we're hoping, because and we want to talk more about this, because our contract is expiring next year, June 30th, and we want to put that into our negotiation that the workers should have a panic button. And we have one company, actually, you know, there's one company that's talking to us about putting hundreds of camera all over the properties, and they even want to put camera into the closet of the workers where we fold our towel. And my question to them is the camera will prevent the harasser to harass the workers?
Right, and there are situations where it's not necessarily just what you see, let's say, from the customer, but perhaps harassment from supervisors.
From supervisors, you know, from, and something that we have to look more, I think, more closer, because I know as my, for my based on my experience that it is happening. It's happening, you know, everywhere.
There were a couple of incidents. I understand that there was a lawsuit filed. I think it was against Hyatt, where there was, according to the lawsuit, there was a situation where a Saudi prince and his entourage had rented a number of rooms for an extended period, and also had special hours for the spa. And you folks don't represent spa workers, correct?
Yes, we don't. We don't represent them. That's why I feel bad for those workers. You know, I just hope that it's not just for Local 5 to really look into this problem about women being harassed or men or just the harass alone. I think it's for the community. We should talk to the politician and just pass it in legislature to like what happened in Chicago. Because the spa at Hyatt, you know, maybe if they are union at the time, they will talk to us and we can represent them, but they don't have a union to really back them up. And there's a lot of places there that don't have union.
Right. And according to, I believe, that lawsuit, the not only was the hotel sued, but the individual, it was a member of the entourage of the Saudi prince, and he pled no contest, I think, to the charges. But the concern is the employee felt harassed and filed a complaint, and it became an issue about who does the hotel protect, the customer or the worker?
Exactly. Based on my experience and don't know nothing about that, and as an immigrant, I always feel like they will protect the customer. And it's sad that I feel that, and I know a lot of workers feel the same way. And I just hope that the things that it's happening now, people will just come forward and talk about what's happening to them.
I'm told that there was also another incident that the union had to step in and get involved, and it affected workers at the Halikoa Hotel. Can you share anything about that?
So workers are being harassed by supervisor at the time, and the workers are actually trying to be a Local 5 member, and some workers come forward and talk about it, but it takes 2 years before it actually get resolved. And again, I know they are scared because we always feel as a workers that customers is always right, and also supervisor, who will the management will protect? Is it me as a worker or is it the supervisor under management?
And did that situation at Halikoa get resolved?
It got resolved, and we did a lot of action. We bring community. We have a lot of clergy come and help us, and actually, but again, it takes 2 years. And those workers are already being harassed, and it's sad to say that after you being harassed, that's when it got resolved. Why can't we just prevent harassment? Why can't we prevent this to happen?
So what happens now? You folks are going to be looking at negotiations because your contract comes up next summer.
Yes.
What's the plan?
So the plan is we're going to, as a Unite Here member, and we know that this is really important for our workers, and it happened in Chicago. They have it in, like I said earlier, it was passed in legislature for the workers to have a panic button, and also in New York, it was put it into the contract, and something that we want to look at it too, and maybe propose it on our next negotiation.
Are you going to try and survey
the members? We're going to try to survey the workers, and we are going to really, really hard to go and talk to the workers and make them feel like, look, it's okay to talk if you are being harassed, either it's yesterday or a decade ago, so that we can talk about it and really try to find a way to prevent the workers to get harassed.
Gemma Weinstein is the president of Unite Here Local 5, which represents hospitality workers in the state of Hawaii. That lawsuit we mentioned, filed against Hyatt in 2014, was settled last year. The complaint details how spa employees were subject to a demeaning lineup while members of the prince's entourage selected who they wanted to book with based on their appearance. The worker was booked to do a facial, but then switched to a full-body scrub, during which she claims she was sexually assaulted. She filed a lawsuit for misdemeanor sex assault and harassment. In a statement, Hyatt said it could not comment about any specific case, but added, broadly speaking, the safety and well-being of our colleagues is a top priority, and we treat all safety concerns raised by our colleagues seriously.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the future of artificial intelligence as predicted in a 1968 movie classic. But first, your quiz.
Before Christmas 2017 is upon us, let's take a step back in time to Christmas 1786 for our backyard quiz. This date is special because it marks the first time anyone ever celebrated Christmas in Hawaii. Historical records tell us that the first celebration occurred aboard the English sailing ship HMS Queen Charlotte, which was one of the first ships to sail to Hawaii following Captain Cook's death. The vessel's captain, George Dixon, woke that December morning and ordered the preparation of a Christmas dinner in order to honor the holiday. Though rations were sparse, the crew was able to concoct an adequate feast with the help of a bit of alcohol. The first Christmas in the islands became a success. For our quiz, we want to know where the HMS Queen Charlotte was anchored when it hosted Hawaii's first Christmas celebration. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Stanley Kubrick's 1968 movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, based on an Arthur C. Clarke short story, was the most prophetic film of its day, showing a world dominated by artificial intelligence that looks a lot like the one we may be entering into. Kyle Oba is half of the design and technology duo Pas de Chocolat. He'll be speaking about artificial intelligence at a 2001 screening tonight in Honolulu. We asked him if the sci-fi classic presented an accurate image of the future.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I think it was. We can go into the details, but I mean, I think there was a lot. I think it was a conscious effort on Kubrick's part, as well as Arthur C. Clarke and the people that they worked with, to make something that was as realistic as they could achieve. Mm-hmm. I suppose. I think one of the original letters that Kubrick wrote to Clark was, you know, I want to make the quote-unquote proverbial good sci-fi film. And I think to him, a lot of that meant authenticity. There's another quote by Kubrick that I think really tells a lot about how he sort of envisioned this film and a lot of his others is that humans don't react well to abstraction. They react to reality, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think he looked at a lot of the – well, I mean, this is a guess on my part, but I think he looked at a lot of the sci-fi films that came before – and took a lot from them, but I mean, a thing that, you know, obviously he added was this tremendous sense of reality.
Yeah.
I suppose. And I know that, you know, from reading about the whole construction and making of the film, that there was a lot that they took out, right? That they had originally planned to do, but they took out because they couldn't get it to look quite real enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the book they were originally supposed to travel to Saturn. But I think Douglas Trumbull had a lot of trouble getting the rings of Saturn to look the way that they thought it should look. And so he didn't achieve that effect until after the movie was done. And so they changed the script so that they actually traveled to Jupiter instead in the film, whereas in the book they traveled to Saturn.
Many of the details of the future that you see in the movie, mm-hmm, are very plausible. You know, the interior of the spacecraft is a Pan Am spacecraft, mm-hmm, right, with flight attendants.
Right,
and
right.
The whole thing. So there are links to the world we know to take us into the future. And yet the thing that was disturbing to audiences, certainly at the time, was this idea that artificial intelligence could run away with itself.
Right, yeah, I've heard it's interesting that it was such a chilling and terrifying view of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And yet I think it motivated like a generation of people to get involved with computers. Just motivating sort of like the imagination about what was possible,
mm-hmm,
but almost like in a by using the darkest prediction about what was possible. I think we were just watching the film recently, and you get to the part where David Bowman and Poole, they go into the pod to avoid being heard by Hal, right?
The computer, the master.
Right. Hal the computer. And they essentially have to find a place in the spaceship where they can't be heard by the spaceship.
How reflective of today is that?
Right. And so, you know, immediately I think about Alexa, right?
Yeah, sure.
And those sorts of home devices. And
well, yeah, you picture yourself saying to Alexa, play some Miles Davis, mm-hmm. and Alexa saying, I can't do that.
Right. Right. I've even had experiences with my family where Siri responds to something that we've been talking about and we think is off.
Oh, really? It's suddenly a voice pops up from the telephone?
It sort of like interjects itself into the conversation, and we just all look at each other.
You know, where's that going to be 10 years from now? I mean, it's advancing so fast, that kind of technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really difficult to try to figure out what 10 years from now would look like. You know, just looking at, you know, the predictions that other people have made about the future, things change so quickly, and we only, I think, you know, maybe I could speak for myself, it's very difficult for me to see the future except through, you know, the things that I know today. And so,
well, let me put it another way, Kyle. What do you see today that would have been very difficult to anticipate 10 years ago?
Oh, I see. That's interesting. Well, I mean, taking it to this, how the computer and how they sort of envisioned artificial intelligence, I think what's interesting is that Hal is essentially the most real human character in the film, and yet today we really don't have anything like that. And I think that a lot of the, I don't know if I should use the word hype, but a lot of the hype around artificial intelligence today is sort of this idea that it will become dangerous and we need to be careful because it's so powerful.
Yeah.
But a lot of what we're using it for right now is not particularly, you know, the general idea of artificial intelligence, like creating another human brain.
Right.
We're really not doing that right now. I think there's probably a lot of people working on it, but what we see a lot of the engineering applications and the commercialization of this technology, it's all sort of like machine learning, right? Lots of compute power and data that sort of does a task really fast or a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And it's things that you don't really associate with human intelligence, but it can appear to mimic it in some ways.
Very advanced mathematical calculations actually are easier, I would think, for an AI setup.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the explosion in the hype of AI today comes from, just having more powerful graphics processing units on computers and more of them, and then cloud services to be able to provision these things fairly cheaply, and then tons of data for which to feed these algorithms. And from that we get software that sort of mimics the behavior of a human in some ways, like being able to recognize a face or...
Yeah. Siri or Alexa.
Right, or voice recognition, things mm-hmm. like that. But also, a lot of software that doesn't really fit the bill in terms of becoming a brain, right? Like, so if it were up to me, I would like to see the research that goes into understanding why a brain works the way that it does advance further, so that would be the type of information, that would be the type of science that informs the inventions that we see in the next 10 years. Right now, it's a lot of linear algebra and GPUs on computers and tons of data, mm-hmm. right, that produce these sort of like engineering applications that we can't really explain other than to say we've trained an algorithm on tons of data to do something for us.
Well, you know, the trope of science fiction with regard to robotics, artificial intelligence, is that at some point the ability to calculate data on a massive scale takes on a kind of volition that you have the proverbial mind of its own. That's what the science fiction writers are in love with, that idea. But there's a big leap between calculation and the human brain, I hope, anyway.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that we just don't really know how the brain works, and to some extent, like, what is thinking and how do we, what makes us distinctly human besides the use of language, for example. The things that we're doing in an engineering sense are, I would say, very, I mean, from what I've read, it's very different than what, the things that we're doing in our brain are very different than what we're training our so-called artificial intelligence to do.
So there's still room for us, Kyle.
yeah, for sure, I think so.
Maybe another couple of generations.
Yeah, it seems like we're working really hard to eliminate the human aspect to a lot of our interactions. Maybe that says a lot about, you know, Silicon Valley or the types of people that are attracted to Silicon Valley, more so than what our technology is particularly good at, if that makes any sense.
Maybe the pendulum will swing back toward human interaction after a certain point.
Yeah, I hope so. I used to live in Silicon Valley, and it almost seems like every new startup is run by, you know, a very narrow demographic of people who is trying to eliminate human interaction from a lot of the transactions that happen either through the iPhone or through the web or through your computer. And I'm not sure if the rest of the world is necessarily like that. I mean, I think that might be what seems profitable or interesting to a certain narrow demographic of the human population, but I don't necessarily think that that's what everybody wants. So, you know, although there's a lot of money in marketing behind those types of endeavors, it not always doesn't always jive with what you see when you go outside.
Kyle Oba is part of the design and technology duo Pain du Chocolat. He'll be speaking in a panel discussion of artificial intelligence tonight at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater. There will also be a screening of the film, 2001 A Space Odyssey, directed by Stanley Kubrick. You can find details on the conversation's Facebook page.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Civil Beat. Joining us now is Chad Blair with a look at the shakeup at the Honolulu Police Department that affects the head of the police officers union. Morning, Chad.
Hi, Catherine. Good morning to you.
Boy, quite a story.
Yeah, Nick Ruby normally would be reporting this. As you know, he covers police for us, but he's gone on vacation, so I'm fortunate enough to be asked to fill in. But it's an easy enough story to tell. Chief Susan Ballard, of course, she's brand new to the job, made a major reassignment, taking Tanari Ma'afala, he's the head of SHOPO, the police union, and moved him off of the peer support unit and actually put him on the midnight shift patrolling Waikiki. It's a pretty major revamp. Ballard was unhappy with the way Ma'afala was running the peer support unit. And by the way, she actually helped found it back in the 1990s. So she feels she has, if you will, some ownership on how it's supposed to operate.
Interesting. So kind of a bit of a revamping and really the first one that we've seen.
Yeah, and there's two other people that were moved as well. There were just three people on this unit. And what the unit was doing was it was mainly volunteer-based, and it was to help officers cope with traumatic events, other things that cause stress. You can just imagine a line-of-duty shootings, drug abuse, domestic violence cases. That was the purpose of the unit, but it really is down in staff. She wants to move it back up to about three dozen people. Ma'afala and others were claiming too much overtime as well. This is supposed to be a volunteer staff. Training apparently had lapsed under Ma'afala's leadership. And they also want to, Ballard in this case, get department chaplains back on board. No comment from Ma'afala. We did try and reach him. As you know, he's been a bit of a controversial figure, leading the police union for a very long time. Staunch defender of the Louis K. Aloha, Ballard's predecessor. So one wonders whether there's some more stuff going on here.
Correct. And he was controversial during the whole same-sex debate at the state capitol for his positions, which, from what I understand, they didn't really represent the department's position on that. But his
the department actually came out pretty quickly after he testified. Remember those 2.5 weeks of that special session? I actually reported on this. Malafala got up there and said he basically refused if gay rights became gay marriage rights became law, which it did. He basically refused to reinforce that or honor the law. Well, the department came and said, well, wait a minute, you know, you're kind of stepping out of bounds here. But Malafala is very strong about his faith. That's very important to him. Not shy about expressing that. The photo that we have running the story today actually shows him with a cross necklace that he's wearing. So a big shift moving Malafala to the Midnight Patrol. He's been there before, by the way. Worked in Waikiki. He was also on the Criminal Intelligence Unit. That's a whole other story. We'll talk about that another time.
Do you think this signals a rocky time ahead for the chief and the union?
It could be. Another way to look at it is a clean slate. Certainly she was promising big changes. That's why the police commission hired her.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That was Civil Beats political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
At this point in our Friday show, we check in with our news director, Bill Dorman, to see what our news department is up to for the coming week. And there's some developments on the medical marijuana front.
Yeah, you know, Chris, this is one of those stories definitely covering from different angles into the new year. And it seems like just as we get to a certain point in this process throughout the dispensary situation,
right,
then there's another twist and turn. And so now... And again, this is all sort of with a look ahead to the legislature opening, you know, in January as well. But there's a group of stakeholders that's been involved up to now overseeing dispensary and patient registry programs. Mm-hmm. But it's folding, and there's still a lot to be done.
A lot to still oversee, right?
Exactly. So we have right now 4 out of the 8 approved dispensaries are open. 2 labs are testing products. There hasn't been as much progress as a lot of folks have wanted on edibles, on oils, on sort of delivery systems other than smoking. And meanwhile, new patient applications are coming in at the rate of about 1,500 a month. So Kuvehi Hiraishi is going to step back, take a look at where we are on this and where we're headed, at least in the first part of the year.
Bill, is there a sense that the dispensaries might have opened too early?
Well, again, it's a little bit of a chicken and egg in terms of how much preparation do you need, and then what was – you'll have folks at the state say, listen, this was new for us. This was a whole new area. Of course, you have to have some expectations going in that there are going to be some adjustment periods.
Yeah.
So, again, I think that the looking ahead in terms of, okay, now we are where we are, but what needs to be done in terms of picking up the pace a little bit at this point?
Adjustment period is a good way to describe it.
Yeah, generous.
And you've got an update on rat lungworm. Yeah,
yeah, this one, another area where progress not as quickly as a lot of folks have hoped in terms of research and funding. Some funding decisions have wound up actually pointing more money towards Oahu than the Big Island, which is, of course, where the bulk of this is,
right,
more about 90%. Several aspects on this. Sherry Bracken's been following this for a while and talking with a number of folks. So next week, she's going to have a two-parter on rat lungworm. And again, sort of give us a sense where we are in the research, where we are in the funding, and a bit of a look ahead with that.
Real quick, Bill, you've got a tale of a remarkable anthropologist.
Yeah, Yoshihiko Shinoto, senior anthropologist at the Bishop Museum for years. He passed away fairly recently, but his work and discoveries really changed our understanding of Polynesian migration, ocean voyaging in particular. 40 years ago, he was the one to first unearth the remains of a large Tahitian voyaging canoe. So things that had been in chants and stories now had physical evidence. His book, Curve of the Hook, just out in English in a revised and updated edition, originally in Japanese. Next week, Noe Tanigawa is talking with his best friend, archaeologist at the Bishop Museum. She's going to have a lot more on Shinoto's story. It's quite a tale.
Sounds like one. Thanks a lot, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
This week on our Talkback Line, we heard this.
Hi, this is Clark from Kauai. And I just want to make a comment on what I've noticed since moving here is the underlying fear of people of confrontation when they call out other people in the community for sexual harassment. It seems like there's a demographic of people that just get away with so much, and not enough people are stepping up to do something about it for fear that they might have to get in an altercation. It doesn't have to come to that. And I find that really interesting for here in the state. Thanks. Bye.
My name is Richard Elsner. I live in Chinatown. My comment is that traditionally men have been the initiators and women the gatekeepers. Men initiate dating, romance, marriage, sex, and women don't do this. And every time a man initiates, he takes the risk of it being sexual harassment. If we really want equality, women have to start being the initiators and take that risk of sexual harassment. I've been single all my life, and as an experiment, when I turned 50, I decided not to ask women for dates anymore. I'm 65, so my experiment's been going on for 15 years. I'm still a good-looking man and friendly, and I'm nice to people. But so far, I have not gotten one initiation. Thank you very much.
Well, following our segment on prepaid health care with Linda Chutakiyama, Jennifer Meehan wrote in on Facebook, "Having returned to the U.S. after 20 years in Asia, I am absolutely shocked by the cost of health care coverage for individuals and businesses, Hawaii and elsewhere. In the short term, such a grant could encourage hiring by employers and give real benefits to workers."
We thank you for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our Talkback line, 792-8217.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
A year ago, Hawaii hosted the International Conservation Congress, and following that came a report from a network of community groups examining our environmental health. Hawaii has lofty goals for sustainability. Now a second report card is in, so how do we fare when it comes to food security, green jobs, and protecting endangered species? Joining me now is Kim Koko Iwamoto, president of the Iwamoto Family Foundation. She represents the foundation's work with the Environmental Funders Group, a network of 17 local and national individuals and foundations that commit active and substantial investment in the environment and sustainability of the Hawaiian Islands. Welcome.
Thank you, Catherine.
Now, before we launch into this year's report, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of that first report?
Right. The first report, we discussed freshwater security, renewable energy, and community-based marine management.
And so how did we fare with that?
Well, it probably led into the second report. And this is why we're discussing local food, invasive species, greening businesses, and green workforce. So they kind of overlap in many ways. And I think if you read the first report, you'll see some of the programs also mentioned in this one.
So give us some framework. So you folks are trying to highlight these issues for really the decision makers, the power brokers.
Right. We have given a copy to all the legislators and the governor's office. And we're also mailing this out to the community at large through it'll be an insert in Hawaii Business and Honolulu Magazine. And the public can also view this report by going to hawaii-environment.com, or they can type in Helonomoku, which is the name of the report.
Okay, so you really want to be able to disseminate this very broadly throughout the state.
Right. We want to make sure that the public and the legislators, that everyone's on the same page regarding, you know, where we are and where we need to go collectively.
Okay, so let's go down the list. Local food. That's one of the things that you folks say it's really important.
Right.
We need to focus
on. So for every one of the issue categories, we highlight a bright spot. And we highlight people who are moving the needle. We also talk about, we highlight stewards in the community. And then finally, at the end of the report, we talk about 9 action items. Mm-hmm. So regarding local food, we highlight ulu, right, as a food source, as a staple, and how we need to kind of, and there's a collective already forming called the Hawaii Ulu Producers Cooperative. We mentioned their work and the importance of that work in keeping Hawaii food sustainable. We also highlight programs like the Roots Program in Kalihi. They are operating through the whole entire Ahapua'a. They have their farm up in the valley. They have a restaurant, a cafe in the Kukua Kalihi Valley Health Clinic. And they also do a farmer's market near the towers at Kuhio Park. So right. We highlight several of the people who are moving the needle forward in this sector.
Right. And I grew up eating breadfruit chips, you know, so I know how
yes.
really delicious ulu is.
Absolutely. And we also have to move towards making sure, for instance, students are able to eat ulu in their public lunches. Wouldn't that be amazing to help them develop that taste across the board? And I know there are some, there is one school lunch provider who does incorporate that, and they're a licensed provider for some of the public schools. So people are working collectively in different ways on moving ulu forward, but also mm-hmm. other food opportunities that highlight sustainability.
Anything else in that area that you think is important to underscore?
And there's also talking about Smart Yields. It's an app that farmers who produce, who grow food, can use to network with each other about, you know, it helps them understand how much rain is coming, potential disease that might be affecting a certain crop. It's a connecting app. So that's one of the other programs that we highlighted under People Moving the Needle.
Okay. Any downsides? Any areas that...
Well, we actually, you know, for food, we didn't really go into the downsides
okay.
Of that. But in terms of the next category is invasive species. And we highlight a bright spot, which is the Alien Species Action Plan. It's a facility at Maui's Kahului Airport. It's an amazing air-conditioned large warehouse where inspectors can open up cargo and look through them. The unfortunate part that's a highlight that we even have that state-of-the-art facility to stop invasive species entering our ecosystem. But we only inspect 2.5% of our of the shipments coming into our state, which is, I think, 34 million pounds of or tons of materials coming into Hawaii, that only, again, 2.5% gets inspected.
Right. And then we have two departments that really work in that area, right? Department of Agriculture and Department of Land and Natural Resources. And those two departments, we know every year after year we hear they're just woefully underfunded.
Right.
And they have just... The responsibility is so great, and
right.
yet the money that we commit behind supporting them is
that's right. So what
minuscule.
We're doing as a HUI, the Environmental Funders Group, we're really bringing it to the attention of the people who approve the budget to say, you know, and also the people of Hawaii, to make sure that they can communicate the need to invest more in preventing invasive species from entering our ecosystem. You know, we're just educating and sharing that knowledge so that everyone's on the same page.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the one other category that you look at is really green jobs, right?
Yeah. We highlight a manufacturing program out of Molokai and their business of making clothing in a green and sustainable way. And that's really important that we have that opportunity. And that's Kealo Pico. And they make no waste manufacturing. Yeah, before we continue, if you don't mind, mm-hmm. I wanted to shout out to Eric Coe and Brent Chillingworth. Eric Coe is with the Harold K. L. Castle Foundation, and Brent Chillingworth is with the Ha'oli Maloa Foundation, and they were our team captains on this particular report. So we want to thank them for their leadership in pulling us all together and making sure that we had great technical support with Sheila Sarangi and Lavon Leong and Janelle Kalavehi-Ching. So they all made this beautiful report that people should take a closer look at.
Right. I mean, these are really important issues, important to our community, important for the future generations. And we really need to be able to spotlight things that are amiss and maybe need more attention.
That's right. And actually, if you don't mind, can I share a passage written by Dr. Nainoa Thompson about mm-hmm. about what you just shared? It basically puts the context of this report forward. So as he writes, as the world changes, we are faced with a choice every day between the dangers of voyaging and the danger of staying tied to the dock because we don't believe we can go. The first path takes us through towering storms and unknown waters, but the second leads to much worse: apathy, paralysis, helplessness. And when we ask the question, what is more dangerous? We don't only raise it to ourselves, we raise it to our children. Our responsibility is to leave them a legacy of courage and progress, not a burden of hopelessness and worsening problems. This report exemplifies the kind of collective action that will be needed to realize our strong shared vision of a sustainable Hawaii. With courage, collaboration, and care for each other, we can get there. And that, again, that's by Dr. Nainoa Thompson.
Very powerful words that really set the tone to Malama the Aina going
exactly.
forward. All right. Well, Kim Koko Iwamoto, thank you so much for being here to share this report, and we will be hearing more about it in the year to come.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Kim Koko Iwamoto is the president of the Iwamoto Family Foundation, which is a member of the Environmental Funders Group. A copy of the group's report, He Lonumoku, the State of the Environmental Report, can be found at the conversation page on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Nutrex Hawaii, makers of BioAstin and Hawaiian Spirulina, dedicated to improving health utilizing natural Hawaiian microalgae. Nutrex-Hawaii.com.
Old black magic has me in its spell.
Old black magic that you weave so well.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with singer Keely Smith. She died Saturday. She became famous for performing with bandleader and singer Louis Prima in the 50s and went on to a long solo career. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, right after Science Friday.
Earlier in the program, we took you back to Christmas Day in the year 1786 for a backyard quiz. 1786 is significant because it's the first year that a Christmas celebration took place in Hawaii. According to records, the first celebration was held aboard the English sailing ship HMS Queen Charlotte while it was anchored in Hawaii to replenish supplies and make repairs. The ship's captain, George Dixon, ordered a celebration that ultimately consisted of a small feast and the consumption of copious amounts of alcohol. For our quiz, we asked you to tell us where in the islands this inaugural Christmas celebration took place. The answer is Waimea Bay on Kauai. Sadly, no one guessed it, because we couldn't give away that tote for Christmas. That's today's quiz, and it's our last one before the holidays. So mele kalikimaka from all of us at The Conversation to you. If you have a quiz idea for us, Christmas-themed or otherwise, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
That's St. Andrews Priory sophomore Marcy Tokunaga, who plays the pedal harp, a 90-pound instrument she toted into our studio the other day. We spoke with her about her chosen instrument. Why the harp?
Because of the angelic sound and the beautiful sound. Also because my piano teacher recommended me to play another instrument, and then that's when the harp came out. I really like to play instruments, and then I want to like be creative to make beautiful sounds.
How does that feel to you? I mean, how would you express it?
Many different emotions, I guess, depending on the song.
Why don't you play us something of a holiday nature, and let's hear how it sounds.
Okay.
Just watching you play that, Marcy, I noticed how you have to kind of get the right hand and left hand to cooperate.
Yes, so it's kind of similar with the piano. We have to use both hands, and we have to cooperate it to make it sound musical and how the song is supposed to be.
Sometimes you have the right hand, as with the piano, or the left hand playing an accompanying role and the other hand doing something different. Was that hard to coordinate?
Not really, because I was playing the piano when I was really young, and then the harp is similar too, except it's like played differently, so I kind of had a hard time with that part.
Strings are set to a fixed pitch, but as they go through the body, they go down to these pedals at your feet. What do those pedals do?
These pedals change the key's tones, so as you move half step up or down, you can change the tone. For example, this is a C flat, or it's also a B, but since it's a C string, it'll be a C flat. And then if you move the pedal half step down to the middle, it'll be a natural C. And then you move one half step down, and then it'll be a C sharp.
So you can get any note in the 12-tone scale on the harp with the proper movement of the pedals.
Yes.
Well, you brought in some holiday music to play. What else have you got?
I also got Silent Night.
Thank you. Marcy Tokunaga is a sophomore at St. Andrew's Priory School. She plays the concert pedal harp with the Priory Chamber Strings Orchestra.
Mele Kalikimaka at Maligayang Pasko sa inyong lahat. This is Julius Torres, Philippine Consul General in Honolulu, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio.
When U.S. service members lose their lives overseas, their death is followed by an elaborate, choreographed ritual that's largely shielded from the general public. For one Army sergeant, this has been his life's work.
You're bringing closure to families and you're bringing folks home.
I'm Ari Shapiro, our profile of a military mortician this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 p.m., following Fresh Air.
Hi, this is Dave Lawrence. We've heard from generals, grandmothers, craftsmen in their workshops, teachers in their classrooms, all saying HPR is the soundtrack of my daily life. Our support base is growing, but we need it to be larger still to sustain our work in the future. Your gift could count towards your 2017 tax deduction, but you don't have much more time. Please become a sustaining member or donate any amount today through our mobile app, and thanks.
And that's it for this week. And as we head into the weekend, The Conversation wishes you and yours a very Merry Christmas. We'll be preempted on Monday for holiday program, but we'll be back on Tuesday.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's a number at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, yet another past show, or links to more information, go to The Conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. The program is produced by Lillian San, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Tuesday and pick up the conversation.